of post secret protection in the last 10 years, and so I'm delighted to tell you what we think we understand. So the menu, after talking about post-concurrent propagation and spending quite a bit of time on that, because I think this is interesting, consists in coming back to Giorgio showed us this morning about the antiprotons, and to you that we understand very well antiprotons as really having a secondary origin. Then I'll talk about the secondary consequence, and I'll show you the uncertainties arising from cosmic ray propagation, because it's interesting to derive, in fact, the uncertainty on backgrounds. And finally, I will just flash a few transparencies about those quotation stupid falsos, which are not that stupid, actually. Somebody's stupid, it's us, because we tend to be quite unable to really understand them, but we'll speak a little bit about that. Okay. So, cosmic ray propagation is important because, as we all know, the Fermi excess and the Fermi measurements and the attic sum are maybe the first hints that a dark matter is made of particles. And those signatures, or those signals, those excesses, distortions, the spectra, are actually maybe clear indications that dark matter is present in the form of WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. So, for instance, if we have in the halo of the Milky Way dark matter particles annihilating into eventually rare antimatter cosmic rays, it's interesting also to carefully study, as was already mentioned all this morning, the conventional background to those signatures, because you cannot claim that you are making a discovery without being absolutely sure, or at least without studying very well the conventional backgrounds to those signals. And actually, the antiprotons and positrons, in a lesser extent, the antineutrons, which I will not talk about, are produced by conventional processes. And one of these processes is the interaction of high-energy primary cosmic ray protons and helium nuclei on the interstellar material. And we need to know what backgrounds are and to assess also the theoretical uncertainty of those backgrounds. And so this is why it's important to understand really the background to the dark matter signatures. In doing so, what we need to do is to model the propagation of cosmic rays, because whatever the sources are, either dark matter particles which annihilate, or pulsars, or spallation of cosmic ray primaries on the interstellar material, we need, as soon as, well, the antiprotons and positrons are produced, we need to understand how those species just travel from the region of production down to the Earth. And so, as Marco presented this morning, this is basically a rapid picture of what is called the diffusive halo, which is a region that surrounds the galactic disk upwards and downwards, where we find a magnetic field and, most of all, in fact, inhomogeneities in the magnetic field. The point is that, well, the magnetic field in our Milky Way is quite turbulent. And because it's turbulent, when you compute the motion of the particles that wind up around the field lines, those particles, in fact, are going to bounce back and forth on the irregularities of the magnetic field. It turns out that in our Milky Way, we know that there is a coherent magnetic field over a few microtals, but there is a lot of turbulence, and it's important to understand how the particles just wander in the inhomogeneities of the magnetic field. So I will start, in fact, the discussion by presenting you an analysis by these people, Fabien Katz and collaborators, who try to model, actually, the propagation of cosmic rays in a turbulent magnetic field. In fact, the theory of the propagation of cosmic rays in a turbulent magnetic field is not quite well understood. You can model the propagation in the limit where the turbulence, delta B here, is very small compared to the homogeneous magnetic field B0. You can use the Boltzmann equation, work out the expansions in first order of delta V of the B0, and you find out that you have mere diffusion. But it turns out that in our Milky Way, the magnetic field is highly turbulent. In other words, B is given by the sum of B0 and that inhomogeneous magnetic component, the turbulent delta B here. Eta is the level of turbulence, which is quite high in the Milky Way, something like that, like one. The turbulence is, in some regions, very large. Then there is a specific length, a current length for the turbulence, which is of order 100 parsecs. What these guys have done is that, well, they've used a Monte Carlo simulation to work out and to understand how particles propagate in a turbulent magnetic field. So they have B0 vertical. They add on that delta B, which is computed with a Fourier transform, in fact, here, where the spectrum of the Fourier transform of the magnetic field delta B is just given by something that varies with the wave vector k as a power of minus alpha. Alpha is positive. So when you go to small scales, k increases, and all the power of the turbulence is on the large scales. And so what they did is that they threw, in fact, particles in that configuration of the magnetic field. And they threw many particles at the speed of light, and they studied, in fact, how they evolved in dozens of realizations of the magnetic field. And they worked out, actually, what is the average of the displacement distance. In other words, well, if you have a vertical magnetic field, you inject particles, and you can see how the square root of z squared evolves with time, and also the horizontal direction. And so you can work out what is the diffusion coefficient. And they found that the transport of the cosmic rays in those turbulences is in the limit of high turbulence, is well modeled by diffusion in space, with a diffusion coefficient along and perpendicular to the B0, the uniform component, fairly equal. And on top of that, well, so they showed that the diffusion coefficient evolves with a longer radius with a power 4 minus alpha, where alpha is related to, in fact, the spectrum of the turbulent magnetic field. And eventually, well, you recover, in fact, the important property that the diffusion coefficient is proportional to the momentum to some power. So this is, they conducted some numerical analysis, and you can see here that in the limit where eta is very large, where one has a high level of turbulence, first of all, they showed that deeper perpendicular, and in the regime where the Larmor radius is less than the current length, which is the regime in which we're interested, this corresponds to the energies of the cosmic rays less than 10 to the 4, 10 to the 4 GeV, so it's a very high energy. So they showed that, in fact, the diffusion coefficient is varying with a power law. And that power law depends, of course, on alpha. In other words, on the type of turbulence. If you take a Kolmogorov turbulence, then delta is equal to one-third. In other words, d is proportional to the momentum to the power one-third. But if you have magneto-hydrodynamic turbulence, then, delta could be of order 0.5. So this motivates, in fact, the model proposed, in fact, a long time ago by Tuskin and Ginsberg in the 70s. It's a phenomenological model for the propagation of cosmic rays, where you picture, and that has been shown by Mariko this morning, you picture, in fact, Milky Way as basically a French cheese box, which is circular and flat. So just in the middle, in the US, we would say a sandwich. In the middle, you have the galactic disk. You have above and beneath the disk, you have diffusion layers where the cosmic rays diffuse. And this is a picture of a typical Milky Way seen by a cosmic ray physicist, where you recognize here the galactic disk. This is the center of the Milky Way. This is the place of Earth. And cosmic rays primaries, in other words, protons and helium nuclei, are accelerated by presumably supernovae driven shockwaves, and they are accelerated in the disk. Then what they do is that they diffuse, in fact, the magnetic inhomogeneities inside the disk and above and beneath the disk in those diffusion layers. The primaries can also be drift away, swept away by a galactic wind that blows upwards and downwards. The primaries also interact with the interstellar material to produce secondary cosmic rays. For instance, in the case of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, those primary CNO that are part of the interstellar material and are accelerated by the shockwaves coming from supernovae. So those CNO primary cosmic rays interact on the interstellar material, they fragmentate, and they generate, in fact, rare cosmic rays, such as boron. And it turns out that if you study the boron over the carbon ratio, you will have lots of information about, actually, the propagation of cosmic rays in the Milky Way. So that seems to be quite complicated, but it's not that much. Something which will be important in the discussion, and which has already been mentioned, is the L here, which is the thickness here of that diffusion layer. Actually, this is something which is quite unknown, and there are various uncertainties, in fact, in all that treatment. And I'm going to elaborate about that, of course, in the next transparencies. There is also energy losses, because in the case of positrons, for instance, as already been mentioned, you have inverse quantum and synchrotron radiation in the magnetic field, so the positrons lose energy. For primary cosmic rays such as protons or helium nuclei, energy losses are not that important. Now you have to remember that, well, the motion of cosmic rays in the Milky Way is just a random motion on the diffusion centers that are the knots of the magnetic field. But those knots, in fact, just move and drift in with respect to the Milky Way. And so because, in fact, the cosmic rays just bounce elastically in the frame of those moving diffusion centers, you may have, in fact, some variation in energy of the cosmic rays, and you may allow a little bit of diffusive reacceleration that comes from the motion of the diffusion centers. Okay, so when one wants, in fact, to solve the transport of cosmic rays in the Milky Way, and what I'm going to talk about is, in fact, something which is also implemented in Galproth, and which comes actually from that old Russian model of the 70s, the Tuskin and Ginzburg model. You need to solve, in fact, that kind of equation where you just write that the divergence of the current for the cosmic rays is given by or equal to the source term. And the current in cosmic rays has several components. So psi here refers to the density of cosmic rays per unit of volume and unit of energy. And it turns out that in the space current here, you have two terms, as I showed you in the previous transparency. You have mere diffusion, and you have convection by the galactic wind that blows upwards and downwards. As regards, in fact, the current in energy, you have energy losses, and you have diffusive reacceleration coming from the interactions and moving centers. So what people in general do when they solve the problem is to assume the state, and in general that is correct for at least a primary cosmic rays, and eventually you end up with that diffusion equation which you want to solve, which is written here at the end of the slide. Now the diffusion, the state diffusion coefficient here is given, as I showed you before, from that analysis by Fabian Cass and collaborators, by that law here where the normalization constant is not known, and the space diffusion coefficient varies as a power law with respect to the energy or the rigidity, which is just the momentum per unit charge. that it's possible to simply relay, in fact, the diffusion coefficient in energy with respect to the space diffusion coefficient by that kind of relation here, where V of A is the velocity of the diffusion centers with respect to the Milky Way. And you want to solve that in a setup which is just a cylindrical flat box, whose radius is approximately 20 kiloparsecs, and the thickness of the disk is something like 200 parsecs, and the half thickness of the diffusion layer is unknown. So you have basically five unknown parameters when you want to solve, in fact, a cosmic ray diffusion problem, namely L, the Alfven velocity, the velocity of the diffusion centers, then the index, which will come to be a very, well, it's important in what follows. It's the index for the space diffusion coefficient, K0 is the normalization constant, and DFC is the velocity of the electric wind. And so, when I'm going to refer to a precise propagation model, it's just to, in fact, to a set of those parameters. So a propagation model is just, in fact, a set of those five parameters. And here is, for instance, an example of three such models. Max, Med, and Mean refer, in fact, they have been denominated like that because the anti-proton primary signal arising from dark matter annihilation turns out to be maximal, median, and average, and minimal in those models. But you should notice here that, for instance, delta is something like 0.46 and could go up to 0.85. K0 is given here, and L actually is something which is quite unknown. The average and value is 4, but it could be as much as 15 and as well as 1. Also, VFC is unknown, and V of A is something with that can vary. Okay, so we know what the setup is, we know what the question is, we know what the parameters are, at least we don't know the parameters, but we know what to look for. Now we want to solve the equation, and there are various ways to do that. So Galtrop uses a very cute numerical approach where they have to use a quantum scheme to solve the diffusion equation. We decided approximately 10 years ago to follow a semi-analytic way, and so we can solve, and I'm not going to bother you with all the equations, we can solve actually the equation using an expansion with Bessel functions of zeroth order along the radial direction, and in some instances we can have analytic derivation along the vertical axis. Some of the results I'm going to show you are derived, in fact, with that semi-analytic approach. Remember just that in the case of Galtrop, it's the same model, but it's numerical. There is still a difference between Galtrop and us. The convective wind, in fact, in our case, varies suddenly from the disk. When we pass from the disk to the confinement layer, it's constant. We assume that it's constant in the confinement layer above and beneath the galactic disk, whereas in Galtrop, it varies linearly. Anyway, so 10 years ago, I gave to one of our students, David Morin, for his thesis, the task to derive, in fact, the limits on the propagation parameters from the boron-carbon ratio, which is quite typical, in fact, of the propagation, as I said, in the Milky Way. So here is an example of the results that David obtained, and which has been published in AJ in 2001, so 8 years ago, where you can see that, well, we can we can constrain the parameters from B over C. But what you have to keep in mind is that B over C gives you loose constraints in the sense that we found something like 1,600 different models compatible with the Brown-Carbon ratio, relaxing, of course, the chi-squared analysis. Maybe we were accepting too many models, but I'm going to show you in a minute, in fact, we decided to keep those 1,600 different models that are compatible with BOC, and so it gives you a flavor of how uncertain cosmic ray propagation is. So there is not just one model. We may find actually the best fit model for the Brown-Carbon ratio, but there is an extension, in fact, around that best growing carbon fit model, which is actually the MET model. The MET model here is where we get the best PwC data.
Is there any information in isotopic composition of boron?
There is. Although that's very interesting. Although, in fact, it depends quite a bit on the local properties. In fact, because when you talk about unstable beryllium 10 over stable beryllium 9, because beryllium 10 is unstable, it pretty looks like actually what happens. For the electrons and the positrons. They cannot come from far away. But very small. Now, I know that Galtrop set some constraints, in fact, on air coming from beryllium 10 to the beryllium 9. So there may be some further constraints. And they tend to indicate that L is maybe over 4 and doesn't spread that much. But in fact, well, let me just comment a little bit more about that. What people thought at first, and in many talks I gave that argument, is that, well, beryllium 10 over beryllium 9 gives you an indication on how thick L is. Actually, no, it's not that way. Because of the instability of beryllium 10, beryllium 10 is produced locally, so you can even work in an infinite diffusive regime, you're not going to have an indication on L. So you can have further indication on the propagation model coming from beryllium 9 and not beryllium 10. Okay. And second thing, well, this is a local thing. So you may have, well, some additional information on K0, the normalization of the diffusion coefficient, but mostly locally. But I agree that, well, the principle should improve on what we've done.
And I couldn't possibly believe that you can fit all the data equally with this broad range of this delta value. I can believe that you can fit boron to carbon ratio, but unless you change other parameters, like the source, for example, source spectra must be different for these different parameters. Otherwise, you will have trouble fitting other data.
Let me present what arises from boron to carbon ratio. I think that, well, if you want to fold in then further data, so beryllium 10 over beryllium 9,
but
as I said,
primaries as well.
Sorry.
Primary spectra as well.
The primary spectra are measured. So what was only in that analysis is that we use, in fact, at the source the injection spectrum so that, well, we recovered the good spectrum measured at the Earth. So because the spectrum at the source is not well known, because you don't know it actually when you accelerate cosmic rays, if the spectral index in the acceleration region at the shock wave, there are strong debates about whether it's 2.1 or 2.2 or 2.3.
So you're allowing the range of source as well.
Exactly. We allow, in fact, the spectral index and the normalization for the source so that, well, we recover, in fact, what is observed at the Earth for the fluxes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the same analysis has been performed. So you see, well, it took a long time before that idea that there is not a single model, but there is a different there is an ensemble of different sets of parameters that can explain, not actually, I agree with you, not equally well, but however, you have a chi-square and you have to allow, and it depends on how harsh you are in throwing away models. But it took a long time before that idea diffused in the community, and we were very happy to see that Dan and Mélanie Simet carried out the same kind of analysis, in fact, with Galprop, which is very interesting because it's the numerical code, and basically I've tried to you performed that the analysis on three parameters because we fixed in fact the convection velocity at value of zero and we took the value of the affine velocity as was set in the code. But frankly, there are some common trends that's very amusing here. For instance, when you take d0xx, which is basically our k0 at value, we scaled at value of 4 GeV for the rigidity, then you find out that there is a degeneracy between L and D and K. So L over K0 is a constant, which actually is here. When you plot, for instance, the values of L as a function of K0 over L, you find that actually it's constant. Because in the equations, it appears really in the semi-analytic code in the expressions which we have. When we better explain things, it turns out that K0 over L is the important parameter, at least for the stable secondary over primary ratio. And you found out that, for instance, the alpha value, which we call delta, is something like 0.4, with quite a large range of L values allowed. I find that's interesting, and I'd like to take advantage of that workshop to discuss with you further more on that. I found that interesting, so I spent some time trying to translate in our code, and it seems that what you found is very close to what we call the minimal, the minimal model, I think. At least in terms not of L, because in our minimal case, L is just 1, although you can go down, but for alpha, we have such a small value either. Anyway. So David Morin is pursuing his activity, so we are trying to convince him to put on the web as his code, his semi-analytic code, as a public code, because it's important that everybody can use it. So in principle, you should do that before the fall, and if he does not do that, then I will ask my student, Timur Delahaye, to work with me and to do that, because it's important to have various tools to compare, actually, the various propagation models. But for instance, this is the latest analysis published, at least by David and his collaborators, using a leaky box model. So it's not a very, very simple model, a leaky box model. And they use the Markov chain Monte Carlo analysis, which is much better than the kind of analysis, the grid, which we used 9 years ago. And basically, with just a pure leaky box, they confirm that basically the delta index is something like 0.7, 0.52, 0.58, and there are various models. But this is just to give you a flavor that we intend to go on along those lines. And with a complete semi-analytic code, we should, in principle, improve actually what we did 9 years ago. And we could implement also beryllium 10 over beryllium 9, although I was not involved in the work for the beryllium 10 over beryllium 9. My colleagues did, and they had problems actually in getting all the beta and stable over stable isotopes at the same time. Fair enough. So, very quickly now, antiprotons as an application of that. For antiprotons, and what I'm going to say here is quite true for even primary cosmic rays. When you solve that diffusion equation, it boils down actually to a simple Poisson equation, just because what only matters is the space diffusion. And so the green function that is associated to cosmic ray propagation, so the probability that when you produce an antiproton here, you detect it at the R there, the green function is just given as the Coulomb potential law. It goes as 1 over R. And because you integrate that green function over the sources, and because the green function varies as 1 over R, pretty much like in gravity and electromagnetism, you find that you are saturated by the remote sources. So antiprotons come from far away, actually. And when you detect an antiproton at the Earth, it comes from a remote region. So that's important to have that in mind. So there are lots of course, mechanisms that will just modify that law. And so before Pamela, we published the predictions about the secondary antiproton flux, that is the antiprotons that are generated by the interactions of cosmic ray protons and helium on the interstellar material, and the 1600 different models, in fact, give you predictions for the antiproton yield that are comprised in that yellow band. So that's really fascinating to see that, well, even though all those sets of parameters are very different from each other, as soon as you try to fix, in fact, P of C, immediately P bar of P is fixed. And so even if in between, well, you're getting lost because L, for instance, could have values as small as 1 or as large as 15, nevertheless, all those 1600 models fall in that yellow uncertainty band. And so, very quickly, as first remarked actually by Marco and his collaborators, the PAMELA antiproton measurements show no excess, in fact, as regards the secondary antiprotons. So because we were equipped with our model for cosmic ray propagation, we carefully analyzed Marco's conclusion. And here is, for instance, in red, the PWP PAMELA data. In yellow are uncertainty band. And I take advantage, actually, that Caragiorgio is here, because in our PRL publication, we had a fight with our colleagues who insisted that the spectral index for the primary helium and hydrogen injection spectra was something like 2.84. You can see the difference of plugging different injection spectra. And I think that if you take 2.84, how much is that, 2.78 or something? So that's interesting, because you are more in agreement with the data points, in fact. Now, of course, well, we will be very happy to incorporate the new data points. Okay. Good. So far for the so good for the antiprotons. So now for the positrons. So the positrons, you want to solve the same diffusion equation, but now what matters is the energy losses. The energy losses are important. And so when you inject a 100 GeV electron at some point, the positron in the magnetic field, the particle will just, in fact, lose energy and diffuse at the same time. So before it reaches the Earth, if it has been emitted a long way or a long distance from the Earth, it has got so much energy that it does not arrive at 100 GeV at the Earth. In other words, the green function, where you inject a particle with an energy of ES, for instance, here, 100 GeV, the green function that relates the probability that a 100 GeV positron arrives after propagating on a distance lambda, on with respect to a certain distance, so that probability, that green function that relates the probability that a positron produced at ES arrives at the Earth with an energy E. That green function, in fact, is just constant inside sort of a sphere. That is the positron sphere, within which, in fact, the positron sphere is centered on the Earth. When you sit at the Earth, well, you can receive positrons and electrons produced within, in fact, that positron sphere or electron sphere. And particles produced outside will not make it, because they will lose energy before they reach the Earth. So the size of the positron sphere is given here on the vertical axis as a function, in fact, of the observed energy, the energy at which the positron arrives at the Earth after having been emitted with the energy, say, of 100 GeV here. Let's concentrate on the red curve. So a positron emitted with an energy of 100 GeV will, on average, in fact, come from a very, very small region if you want to detect it with an energy of 90 GeV. Here it's better. So you have 90 GeV here, and you can see that basically the positron sphere has a thickness of something like 400 parsecs. Whereas, of course, well, if you inject a 100 GeV positron and detect it at 10 GeV here, you see that the positron sphere has a radius of 3 kiloparsecs. In other words, at very high energy, because of those energy losses, the positrons which we detect cannot come from far away. And so the green function, in fact, tells you that the high energy positron flux is produced, in fact, locally, because positrons at high energy lose very, very efficiently energy and will not make it down to the Earth. So we applied our semi-analytic propagation code to recompute the secondary positron flux. So far, in fact, people have used, and even here, I think this morning, we've seen what is called the Strong and Muscalenko, the background from Strong and Muscalenko. And here is actually the spectrum. And what people do is that they have been for years using the Strong and Muscalenko predictions of 1998. Those predictions have been have been parameterized by Boards and Ezio, and we decided to redo the job and to examine the various sources of uncertainty. So there are sources as regards uncertainties as regards, for instance, the cross sections, because when you have contractions of protons and helium on the interstellar material, there are various mechanisms at stake, and depending on which parametrization you take for the pi cross production, for instance, you can end up with differences between the blue and the red curve. And eventually, we decided that we should use, for instance, the CAMA parametrization, which is a global fit to all the available data. So this is the source term. And the source term, just because it's an interaction of primary cosmic rays, with spectral index is 2.7, the source term varies as 1 over your energy to the power 2.7. So here is an example where we have in red the top of the atmosphere and in blue the interstellar secondary positron flux, and you can see here variations as regards different cross-sections of production. Now, of course, while there are slight variations as regards the injection of a spectrum of primary protons and helium, it's not very important, but mostly there are actually variations coming from propagation. So here is the total absolute flux for secondary positrons, and the yellow band encompasses the 1600 different models which I showed you previously. So you can see that there is an uncertainty band arising from B over C and the lack of knowledge of propagation. So let me briefly show you a few things before I go to discussing the dynamics. So if we take the CAMA parametrization, here is what we get. If we take instead the Badoer parametrization for Pasdar production, then this is what we get. So the business is uncertain in terms of production of cross-section and propagation. So far I've not showed you the diffusive reacceleration, because everybody has been using actually a prediction by Strong and Muscadinko where diffusive reacceleration has been switched off. So this is what happens when you have diffusive reacceleration. Diffusive reacceleration is very funny because on the one hand side, at high energy, positrons lose energy, and diffusive reacceleration takes the low energy positrons and shift the energy upwards, and so they collide at around 10 GeV. And this is, for instance, what happens when you have no diffusive reacceleration and diffusive reacceleration. So there is a completely, you have a bump at 10, at a few GeVs. This bump, well, in real data, is not that significant. And okay, so let me just show you the situation before for me. So that was the situation last October, where we computed, in fact, the positron fraction. In that positron fraction, the E plus comes into play, and the E minus also. So for the E minus, we used the available electron data, and so we fitted the AMS electron data, and we used then some parametrization at high energy coming from the analysis by Casali and Bindi, and depending on the electrons which you select, of course, depending whether you have hard electrons or soft electrons, you could eventually maybe have a plot where you could think that maybe the Pamel excess is not that a problem. Of course, this was before Fermi, first of all, and then actually when you look at in detail in those analyses, what matters is not the uncertainty band, but the trend of all the models here. So in all the models, you cannot, in fact, reproduce that increase here. So, okay, we've seen that this morning, and that's very great because
sorry,
we have.
Sorry. What is the continuation of this plot after 100 GeV?
For our plot?
For the model.
I think we extended that to pretty high energies. I think it goes, in principle, yeah, okay. In principle, let's see. The flux of positron is proportional in terms of the energy to epsilon to the minus. So it's 2.7. So this is alpha, my alpha. So the spectrum at the source. And then you have the propagation of positrons, and at high energy, this comes to be epsilon to the minus 1/2 minus delta over 2. So in principle, it should go along. I think it's, I expect that it goes wrong. I've not plotted it, although well, we get results up to 10,000 GeV. Okay, so we've seen the Fermi data, which give us, in fact, a nice measurement of phi electron plus phi positron. And eventually, when you fold in, fact, the Fermi data with our calculation and with uncertainty band, here is what we get. We get an excess, in fact. And so we, although there are uncertainties, although we could square down those uncertainties with the beryllium 10 or the beryllium 9, there is definitely an excess. So I would conclude today that there is an excess in terms of the secondary production, and so there is an additional source for positrons. So everybody is convinced here, so I'm not, you know, I'm breaking an open door, but nevertheless it was interesting to do that analysis. A few things. It's possible actually to explain the Fermi data just by primary electrons plus secondary electrons and positrons. In general, it's believed that electrons are accelerated in supernuclear-driven shockwaves. And then on top of that, you have the production of secondary electrons and positrons. And if we forget about, in fact, if we forget about the Pamela excess, then it's possible to have here an explanation in terms of those Galprop model 1 and 2, where you have, in fact, you can explain the absolute phi the flux of electrons and positrons. Of course, then you do not at all explain the Pamela excess. Okay, so there is an excess, and so I was asked to briefly mention something which I know basically nothing about, but I can make some comments nevertheless. So pulsars. So a pulsar is a magnetized neutron star that rotates with its magnetic field that is not lying on the rotation axis. And the thing is very interesting because as it rotates, you have a magnetic field in the framework of the rotating neutron star. And if you do a Lorentz transformation, or again, Lian transformation, close to the neutron star, you can convert, in fact, the magnetic field into an electric field. And so you may have regions where you have, in fact, some sort of a divergence of the electric field with a charge, some sort of an effective charge density. And this results into strong electric fields going up, going outwards or inwards, in fact, the surface of the neutron star. And so the electrons that are in that system are accelerated along those electric field lines. And you have a complex series of processes where these accelerated electrons are going to spiral in the magnetic field of the neutron star, and you have production of curvature photons. Those curvature photons interact with the magnetic field itself. The electrons and the particles will heat up the surface of the neutron star that emits X-rays, and you have an intricate set, in fact, of processes that end up with the production of E plus and minus pairs. So I had a chance also to attend a workshop where Anatoly Spitkovsky, who is an expert on the neutron stars, complained about the very few number of people involved in neutron star physics, because it's really an interesting field of physics, and it's difficult actually to cope with all the aspects of the processes involved. Okay, so there has been, and you've seen already this, there have been some proposals to explain the positron excess in terms of pulsars. You all know this. Well, you may have local pulsars, which could introduce some stochasticity in the signal. However, what I got in mind was that although this could seem plausible, and there are many pulsars, first of all, it's very difficult to get the proper spectral index at the production for pulsars. What you require is an index, a spectral index of 1.5, and 1.5 doesn't seem to be that easy. And also, although you could think it's reasonable and normal, you need, in fact, a large fraction of the energy lost by the neutron star that eventually, in fact, comes into E plus E minus. Okay, so here is basically, so Dan and Stefano, Dan and Pasquale and the two Pasquali work on pulses, and they show that it's a very reasonable explanation, although you still have that problem with the spectral index. The analysis has been redone, actually, maybe more carefully in terms of the background only, by Dario Grasso, I think, where you can actually explain the Fermi data with two nearby, the same as Dan used, pulses. And then when you fold in, fact, the pulses within the sphere of 3 kiloparsecs in radius, and you don't know actually the parameters that are at stake for the pulses, because for the pulses you need to know, I will stop. What is the fraction of the energy that comes into E plus minus? You need to know when the injection takes place, because it's not a stationary solution. You have to take into account the time duration of things. There are many things to take into account. You find some variations. Okay, last thing, as I was already mentioned, Pasquale Blasi came with a cute explanation where he thinks that in the supernovae driven shocks, you may have acceleration, and at the same time, you can have spallation reactions. In other words, in the model which I showed you, and which is used in GALPROP and in our code, you assume that you have acceleration, period. So you inject cosmic rays in the Milky Way, and then you follow them in their diffusion motion, and they can interact afterwards. So if at the same time you accelerate them and you produce secondaries, you may in fact shift the secondary abundances upwards. And so Pasquale found a cute way to explain the Panama excess with that kind of process. Although there are clear predictions, if you have this, you should have P bar over P increasing and P bar over carbon ratio increasing at high energy. And so his explanation is testable in the near future. So maybe Pier Giorgio, you'll have some comment about that, because the latest point for the antiprotons may actually be in contradiction with that. This is my last transparency as a conclusion, le mot de la fin. So this plot has been published 20 years ago, and I leave it for you for your appreciation on that Greek version of history, which is cyclic. You can see that, well, 20 years ago, Ahmed Boularès published in 1989 a paper in a JA where he tried to explain the positron excess with pulses. I thank you very much for your patience.
Very politically correct things here on the side. Anyways, comments and questions to Pierre? Sorry. Alan?
Just on the antiprotons, there have been a couple of groups, recently that have been trying to play around with the absolute normalization. So if you assume you don't change the shape, but you just try to move it up or down, is there flexibility to do that given knowledge of the primary sources?
Okay, in the calculations which I'm going to show you here, we don't have that actually. We don't have that latitude. Unfortunately, the cross section for the production of antiprotons is well known. And when you measure, you take one of the 1600 models, and in GALPROP it's exactly the same thing. You take a model compatible with BOC, and what you do is you measure the primary and helium spectra at the Earth. You use your model to retropropagate that in all the Milky Way, so you know what is given a certain model of propagation. You know actually your sources, and the flux is predicted, and there is no way to play around when you agree with BOC. At least this is our conclusion. Now, of course, well, I guess that you have in mind that analysis by Let's see. The name's
Keane.
Yes, Gordy. Exactly. Gordy's proposal, where he has found he claims that he has found a model that is depleted in RTE protons at low energy, which is still compatible with the Brown carbon ratio. So this is what he claims. And for our point of view, we got our 1600 models, we plugged that in our code, which is a very simple code, and bingo, we got the...
So you would say the sources are well enough known that you can't, basically you can't suppress it.
I would say so. I hardly see what process is at stake in order to be both compatible with BOBC and still, to not give you the proper PWP ratio. So I hardly see that. At some point, there were some problems in GATCOP. At least, the people claimed that they had problems with anti-protons and claimed to have a fresh new component. As far as I understand, in the Fermi collaboration, they use actually the anti-proton measurements to fix the propagation curve. So
I can just comment on that. I don't know whether your question is about that or not, but constraint can come from the data itself, and actually from the best data, compared to the earlier data, newer data tend to have slightly lower flux at the maximal energy. That's where the normalization issue came from. Okay. So the models, Moskalenko's model actually had to be readjusted to fit that data, which actually helped the reacceleration model. So they did not have to have this inconsistency or difficulty with antiprotons by having this lower flux.
Okay.
All right, it's time to move on. Let's thank the speaker.